we welcome back to the program, as we do every Tuesday, our friend, author Colin Fleming. Hello there, Colin.
Hey, what's up, Kimball?
I'm losing my voice. I don't know what's up with that, but we're getting through it. We're fine. No pain, no suffering, just no voice.
Little honey tea, you'll be right as rain.
Did that this afternoon, and it is a little bit better, but I was telling Carrie, I realized I have a very limited skill set. If it doesn't involve talking, yeah, I'm pretty much done.
You are all about the voice. At least you're candid about it, so.
Well, I can't build anything. I can't make anything.
You don't know. You could cope. It's like when people lose one thing, they discover they can do this other thing. Who knows? I was saying to my mother the other day that maybe Grandma Moses had never tried painting. And someone said to her one day, hey, why don't you give this a shot? And then she did. And there was that whole late arc to her life. And my mother's not taking up painting, but maybe you could.
All right. Well, before we talk about this, some terrific works of horror and audio version, I have to get your thoughts on what we witnessed last night from our favorite athlete, the great, the money man, Chris Sale.
You know what? It was good, though, because I didn't find out about it until afterwards. That's how tuned out I am. I checked the scores, of course. I checked the standings. I see that the Red Sox are as many games back in the division as they are. And then you look at the other division, you see these teams that are 6-17, and they're less games back than the Red Sox are in their own division, because the American League East is pretty good, but Chris Sale is not. And you know what? I realize no one wants to go out there when they're there and fail. I sometimes I think sports fans, they almost talk about it as if the athletes don't care whether they fail or not. And obviously that's not true. What bothers me so much is the lack of professionalism, that you have an adult who clearly cannot control his anger, and he threw a tantrum last night in the dugout, and that's just what we're seeing. And then you know the post-game sound is coming where he says, I bleep and bleep. And it's just so, maybe grow up. Maybe get the anger under control. It's hard to respect a man who can't control his anger. Right, Kimball?
Yes, and I was thinking about that when I read your piece earlier on the blog, Many Moments More. Is there any other profession beyond the world of sports where grown men can be so blatant in their inability to control their anger?
Publishing. I have a good example coming up
about
that on the blog. But it's like, I was having this conversation with someone the other day, and I said, how can you be an adult and you can't think it's effective to behave in certain ways and to say certain things? I was reading this story today about this lawyer who was liquored up at like midnight and was going after some blogger and was putting down all of these things, and not a paper trail, of course, but a digital trail, and just sounding, he was like 65 or whatever. It's like, can you not help that? It's not an effective strategy. It's not going to get you what you want. It's going to make things worse for you. And I was talking to my friend. I was like, it's like people, they just can't, they actually can't physically control themselves that way. And they're an adult. It's not like a two-year-old. What's that age, the terrible twos?
Mm.
Many adults are that way. And I sit back and it blows my mind. I mean, there were times in my past where I wasn't in the control that I wanted to be, but you grow up, you adapt, you change. It's just hard for me to sort of wrap my mind around it, behaving like that. And he knows the camera's on him. He knows how it looks. It just speaks to how little control he has, that even with those things in place, he can't stop himself.
It's that, or maybe that's all part of the performance, too. I'm not convinced that he's not doing it for the cameras.
Yes, so I understand that. I think that's a good way of thinking, because he's just so performative. That's the thing that really put me against him, is that he performs this tough guy act. And I'm not a big, like, fake tough guy fan. The performative tough guy shtick, I find that just so off-putting when people are not themselves. And I told you, I know it was a winning effort and everything, but when he came out for that World Series, that bottom of the ninth against Los Angeles, after defecating the bed over and over and over again so he could have the money shot hero moment. Totally fraudulent. And he smashed up TV, right, in the minors with that last year. Makes sense. The thing, when he, remember when he was on the White Sox, he's taking scissors to, like, the third uniform that they were wearing on Wednesday.
Yeah, we were
like
talking
that.
About that earlier, the throwback uniforms. And it wasn't just his, it was all of them, so nobody could wear them.
If you had, if you learned that a child had done that, like a child in like your extended family or a child at school or something like that, people would get involved, right? There would be a guidance counselor or developmental counselor or psychologist or something like that involved. It wouldn't be like, this was normal for little Timmy to do, and he was just acting out. It would be more, there's something deep-rooted going on here. And you're making all this money, Chris Sale. Be a part of the job isn't just pitching and pitching effectively. It's acting like an adult and being a professional. That just seems like maybe a lost art these days, but he epitomizes how far gone that art is.
Absolutely. Well, we're talking with Colin Fleming on Downtown. On to the subject at hand today, which is a treasure trove of some great horror stories and some terrific either spoken word or theatrical performances that all on this website. Tell me about, what is it, Holly Wraiths? That's a great collection of items.
He does. I think it's a he. He does have a great collection. Now, that was just for my convenience and rounding them up and sending them to you because they're all over the place. Like the E.F. Benson one, for instance, is on BBC Sounds currently. And when I listen to the Legend of Sleepy Hollow reading, it's kind of a performance, really, which I think is the best of that there is for that particular story. It's actually from a different place, so I just thought this would be handy than if you wanted to, because like you said, there's so much good stuff there, such an archive. You might find some things on your own that you liked. I guess someone reported this guy because there was like a copyright violation, but people, they really have nothing to do in their lives. So I guess with YouTube, it's three strikes and you're out and the channel comes down, so there's some danger of that happening. But yeah, I guess the premise was these things were loosely based around radio programs that came out in the Christmas season. It doesn't mean that they're Christmassy. It just means usually that they're haunted and they're spooky because that's the seasons we've talked about many times of ghosts, I think even more so than Halloween. And so I thought this was like a pretty good brace of programs.
Yeah, I like the version of Casting the Runes, the M.R. James story, the Hex, as they call it, and a strong version from 1980.
Right, it's updated, so much more modern than we think of as of M.R. James. I mean, 1980, so when this story is happening then, you have, I mean, these people could be listening to The Clash's London Calling. Kind of a strange, we don't really think of M.R. James that way. So it's Casting the Runes, which became a movie in the late 1950s, and Night of the Demon. It's about this guy who is feels like he's been wrongly neglected, passed over in his academic career. He's a big believer in sorcery as this thing that actually works. So to get revenge, kind of like that that Vincent Price vehicle, Dr. Phoebs was always wanting like revenge on people who didn't give him good theatrical notices. He is putting this hex of the title on people, and it's quite clever the way it works, that you have to have these runic letters that just spell bedevilment, and you have to give them to someone as a piece of paper so that they willingly accept them. So you have to trick them into taking them. You can put them in a book, you can whatever that might be. And then once you realize that you have this hex, this is the conundrum, so that the good guys don't die in this story, is that you have to find a way to give it back to the guy who's doing everything he can. He's actually taking a train to go away, to stay away from you. So I think that's a cool thing for the plot to hinge on.
I had not read or heard E.F. Benson's Terror by Night, and it was a short program, 14, 15 minutes, but wow, that was intense.
Benson is he's probably my favorite ghost story writer, and I think the pendulum swung a bit too far in M.R. James's direction. A lot of what James did was born out of his own repressed tendencies as an academic, and so he's fairly one note, and he didn't think of himself as a writer so much as someone who wrote stories to entertain his friends. Benson was a voluminous writer. He, with the ghost stories, he was one note in a way, but it's a much different note than that of M.R. James. There's a companionable, collegial quality to E.F. Benson's ghost stories that I like, and that's how this story works, that you have these guys that are hanging out, they're together, and there's this bad vibe, and there's someone off that they care about, a woman, and there's going to be this untimely demise of her. And the way the story is set up is this notion of transference, that if you're in a hot room and it's cold outside and you open the window, in comes the cold air to cool everything down. Who's to say that the supernatural and ghosts aren't that way, that there's something happening in another place that has reverberations in a different place? And so that's what the story is about, how these different men are all impacted differently where they are when this person that they care about somewhere else succumbs.
It's very good. I need to explore more E.F. Benson. Obviously, we've talked about Shirley Jackson, and you've made the point before that most people know her for The Lottery, but you think The Haunting of Hill House is a far better work, and this is really a nice reading from the late 90s by Emma Fielding.
True, I do. I think The Lottery is, speaking of one note, very one note itself. It's more of a parable than a flesh and blood story, whereas The Haunting of Hill House is not just a flesh and blood horror story. It's one of the few long-form versions of one. Word count wise, that works. I think it was Shirley Jackson at her best, because really, what the best horror stories and ghost stories are about aren't the ghosts, and they're not the ghoulies. They're a part of those stories, but they're really about the people. And this is an intense psychological study of someone who is lonely and depressed and looking for a place to belong and people with whom to belong, and Eleanor. So you have these people in this dire house with this bad history, very bad juju in this house. And the way she's treated it sometimes by the people, like when the woman who's clearly there's a sapphic dynamic between the two of them, whereas Eleanor is almost asexual and she's had so little worldly experience taking care of her now deceased mother. And that quasi-friend sort of turns on her. There's a frat boy type who goes whatever way the wind blows and isn't really like the most loyal friend. We sort of question the motives in some sense of the scientist who's helming this particular project. And she becomes more and more lost, even amongst these people that she's supposed to be sharing this experience with. And so the whole sequence where the writing is on the wall. The actual writing is on the wall. It's both literal and metaphorical about help Eleanor come home. I think it's just one of the more astute, kind of penetrating, terrifying psychological components to a modern ghost story that I'm aware of. So sometimes I drift off to this at night. I have this playing on the phone in the bed, and then I wake up and I'm like, no, get out of there, Eleanor. Don't let that house keep you. And then it takes me a while to fall back to sleep again.
Well, and like the best writing, the scariest things are right in our own imagination. And what I like about The Haunting of Hill House is the subtlety of it all.
You're told with ghosts that they can't actually hurt you. And there's no record of, so far as we know, like a ghost wielding a spear and like chucking it through your neck, something like that. But even though we know the prevailing wisdom, we don't think that. We think that the ghosts that we meet right, when that does happen, is going to be the spear chucker. And we're going to have to contend with that on top of everything else. We're going to be that exception because the doors close mysteriously and open mysteriously in this story. But there aren't these bogeys walking down the hall, like ready to suck the blood and everything. But it's more scary, I feel like, because of that. Some misguided authors will say that you have to show the monster. I don't think those authors understand what a true monster is. The monster is an internal construct, and it can be amplified by an external presence. But the monster, we always come back. It's like I said to you a while ago, the scariest thing for the scariest monster out there is always the mirror. It's always that. It's not Dracula. It's not Hill House. And Eleanor, I think, is someone who had she survived this ordeal, would retroactively agree with that notion.
I really enjoyed this version of such an atmospheric story of The Willows by Algernon Blackwood. Wow.
Blackwood is he's overlooked, and I don't know that Blackwood, there are days that I'm prepared to say that he's better than the people as a writer that we've been talking about. He's better than M.R. James, maybe, even better than my sort of go-to guy with E.F. Benson. Blackwood, The Willows, is a perfect, it's a long story, it's a perfect story. It's about these two buddies on a trip down the river in a rafting trip, a canoe trip. And the willows along the banks have their own agency. They have their own rituals that they're enacting, and that these two people have sort of wandered into a place where they're not meant to go while all of this is happening. And there's going to have to be a necessary sacrifice, and these two friends are going to have to fight to save each other. And it's simply nature. It's simply these willows. And think of what a willow is. A willow in and of itself isn't an imposing plant, right? They're pretty like willowy by definition. And yet the rustling and the sound and the somatic quality of the story and these inexplicable occurrences that, like, there's a cut in the bottom of the canoe. An oar goes missing. I mean, we don't think of a willow all of a sudden walking up like it's the Sorcerer's Apprentice type of thing and like, ooh, I'll just squirrel this away. But it somehow still happens, and we believe it because that's the law of this particular territory, this hellish ecosystem that these two guys have come downriver into.
And then when they come upon a body, oh my.
Oh, the body is it's not even just coming upon a body. It's what has happened in consistent geometrical intensity and form to the body that's in keeping with the actual symbolism of the other occurrences that they've been dealing with. And so earlier in the story, there's that body that we are going to end up seeing in the end is foreshadowed. This creature, this lolling creature, seems to be tumbling over and over in the river somewhere off, and they can't quite make it out, and they think it's a body. And one of the guys is like, that's an otter. And we never really even know what that was. We don't, after the story is complete. Could have been a different body, could have been an otter. We don't know. There's just things that you aren't going to know. So I feel like what you really want to do with any story, not just a horror story or a ghost story, you want to be clear, but you also want to leave some mystery. You want to leave something where someone can say, I think it's apples, and someone else can say, well, I think it's oranges. And so without forsaking meaning. And it's one of those technically perfect stories. Blackwood, he wrote so much and he did so many different kinds of things, but this is one of those vehicles where I feel like he got everything completely as it should be.
And I think it's a very powerful technique. that you don't see a lot in this type of writing. When a person looks to do harm to themselves, it's the environment in this case that's driving them toward that. But to me, that's sometimes even scarier than another person or another force inflicting harm on them.
One of the scariest things about the story is when the trust subtly begins to erode between the two men.
Mm.
And we're given one person's perspective more than the other's by nature of the narrative device. But we start thinking it too. We start thinking, one of these guys just like gaslighting this guy out in nature and messing with him and messing with us because we're peering in. And it turns out not to be, well, it seems, the case at all. But then just the possibility of that ups the horror. It's like two's company, three's a crowd. We're already dealing with enough here. And then you introduce that element of looking over your shoulder with someone that you're sufficiently close with, that you're going off on this holiday together where you're going to be sleeping side by side. You're going to be rowing side by side. And then you find out, maybe I don't know this person at all, or you start thinking that way. And then the corollary to that is, what do I know? Do I know anything? Is this person true? Is this other thing that I thought viable? Did this person over here love me? And it's just, it's a lot for your canoeing vacation.
And finally, boy, it's great when you can take a story that we all know very well, we've seen or read in many different forms, and give it new life. And this is a wonderful presentation, production of The Legend of Sleepy Hollow.
It's read by Martin Jarvis, and there are all sorts of sound effects, I'd say. But then sometimes it's straight reading. But I find this delightful. I listen to this a lot. A lot of times with these spoken word recordings or radio programs, I treat them as if they're music records. So I'll listen to something, Carlton Hobbs, Sherlock Holmes broadcast, like I don't know, 50 times a year, the way that I might listen to Sergeant Pepper. And this is one of those spoken word recordings that I return to a lot. I can just hang with this. I can just, do you know what I mean? I just would like buddy up with it and put it on when I want to sort of unwind and get ready for the next day. And again, it's that notion of there's not a lot of perfect art out there. This is a perfect story that Washington Irving wrote, and I think it's a perfect audio representation of it. It captures the sly wit, the horror, the Americana, the early days of the Republic, the ghost of the wood, the gossip of the town, the social structures, a mild form of sort of, it sounds like a contradiction, innocent bullying. And I also love the idea. It's made me think about wanting to do this at some point myself. The story comes from a work that is a hybrid. It's part nonfiction and it's part fiction. You can't just jam stuff together to do that. You have to have an overarching premise. And Washington Irving, he just hit that perfect note. The bluesman, Big Bill Brunsey, would always say, you have to hit the right lick. And Washington Irving, who predated, obviously, the musician, he hit the right lick. He hit the right lick with that book. He hit the right lick with this story. And this modern audio telling of the story hits its own right lick.
Colin Fleming, every Tuesday afternoon here on Downtown. Be sure and visit his website at colinflemminglit.com. Subscribe to the blog, which is more of a journal. It's a life's work, and you get to see an artist putting it all out there for you. That's the Many Moments More blog. Colin, we thank you as always, and we'll check in next Tuesday.
Okay, sounds good.